Hi, I'm Connor Cyrus, one of the hosts for Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. This Sunday marks the start of the Lunar New Year, a major holiday for people in many Asian countries and for Asian Americans. Later in the hour, I'll speak with the chef at a renowned Chinese restaurant in Burlington about her Lunar New Year traditions. But first, today on the show, we're trying something a little different. We're going to be taking a museum tour together. Winter is the perfect time to hop into one of the region's many museums. And today we're focusing on art. We'll visit three different art centers today, two in southern Vermont and one in New Hampshire. Now, our first guest on this art tour joins us from Brattleboro, where he directs the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center. Danny Lichtenfeld, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Michaela. So nice to speak with you.
Now, I understand that a pretty rare Keith Haring exhibit is opening at your museum pretty soon. And for listeners who may not know Keith Haring, obviously this is the radio, so we can't show anybody a picture right now. So can you tell us a little bit about this artist and maybe like paint us a visual of what his work, his most iconic work looks like?
Sure. Yes. So we have an exhibit opening here at the Brattleboro Museum on February 18th of work by Keith Haring. And if you don't know the name Keith Haring, there's a decent chance that you may still have a picture in your mind of his, that you may be familiar with his work. He was active in the 1980s in New York City, and he's known for these almost like stick figure kind of drawings of people dancing and celebrating, or a crawling baby with lines emanating from it, like a glowing, radiant baby, or barking dogs. And Haring did a lot of his work in public spaces, including in the subway, but also mural projects around the world. And he was so committed to having his work be accessible to the general public, not just to people who go to art galleries and museums, that he created a shop that was open for a number of years in New York City called the Pop Shop, where he printed t-shirts and bags and all kinds of products. So his imagery is out there. You can buy sneakers with Keith Haring imagery on them, kind of like every product you can imagine. You can bump into Keith Haring imagery.
And Danny, one of the things that's so interesting to me about Keith Haring is that he is one of those artists that now his images are so iconic. And if you still don't know who we're talking about, and you could Google it real quick, do it. I'm guessing you'll know exactly what these images look like when you see one. But he's somebody who is so much part of like the pop culture world now, but he died pretty young, right? And he had a very different level of success during his life compared to what his legacy is, right?
Well, he achieved great success and fame during his lifetime, but you're right. He died young. He died of AIDS at the height of the AIDS epidemic, and the way it affected the arts community and the queer community. He was right in the middle of that. So he died at age 31 in 1990. He was originally from a small town in Pennsylvania, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and went to school in New York City at the School of Visual Arts in the late 70s. And he began doing work in public around 1980, a little bit earlier, very late 70s. But then he, these drawings called the subway drawings, which are actually some of which are the works that we're going to be showing at our museum, for a couple months, these really catapulted him into the public eye. And before long, by about 1982, he was not only known to people on the street who saw his work in public places, but he also became a real star in the art world. So he had gallery shows and museum shows and was commissioned to do mural projects and things around the world. So he enjoyed great success during his lifetime. But yeah, then he tragically died young.
Wow. Well, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the director of the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center, Danny Lichtenfeld, and we're discussing an upcoming exhibit there that features works by Keith Haring. And if you have visited an art museum recently and want to tell us about what you saw, give us a call, 800-639-2211. Or if you're an artist with some exciting new work that you want to share, again, that number is 800-639-2211. So, Danny, as I understand it, a lot of the Keith Haring works that you'll be exhibiting were made with chalk on paper that was like pasted onto posters. Am I getting that right? It almost just sounds kind of miraculous that they survived until now.
Yes, you are getting it right, and absolutely miraculous. And so I'll tell you a little bit of the story behind that. Haring was a student and just getting his legs under him as an artist in New York City in the late 70s, early 80s. And he was really inspired by graffiti artists. He would sometimes go down into the subway just to watch the trains come by so he could look at the different graffiti on the trains. And he loved the youthful energy in that. And he also really loved the fact that this was art that could be seen by anyone, anywhere, not just people who choose to go to museums and galleries. And so before long, he embarked on sort of his version of creating publicly accessible art in a similar vein. And so what he observed was that at that time in the subway stations, you know, there are posters on the walls advertising movies or, you know, different things. When the ads would expire, the subway authorities would paper over them with black paper until they came in with, you know, to put up the next ad. So Haring had the idea that he could use these black rectangular spaces to quickly draw a drawing, but since it's black paper, he has to draw with white. So he carried chalk around with him and would take the subway around the city. And when he saw any of these blank advertising spaces, and if he thought he wasn't going to get caught because this was considered like graffiti or vandalism, he would jump out of the subway and quickly draw on the black paper. And he wouldn't sign his images. His style sort of became, and the recurring figures in the images almost stood in as a signature instead. And before long, he was, you know, there was a lot of buzz and a lot of talk about who's this guy who's doing the drawings, or I happen to see the guy who does the drawings. I mean, he wasn't like really trying to keep his identity secret,
right?
But he also, you know, he wasn't putting his name there. And so it became quite a phenomenon. Now, these drawings would very quickly get torn down by the subway authorities, either torn down or papered over with the next ad.
Right, because at that time in the 80s, graffiti was seen by cops and others as like a major problem in the city,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And So he did thousands of these drawings over a period of about 5 years from 1980 to 1985, the vast majority of which ended up, you know, in the trash or underneath layers of other posters. But some of them survived, and including the group that were of drawings, about 20 of these drawings that we're going to be showing here in Brattleboro, starting February 18th. And the way these particular drawings survived is that there was a young man in the city who was a handyman and a building superintendent who bumped into Haring creating one of these drawings at one point. And he was totally enthralled and fascinated and got to talking with him. And he was just the kind of person that Keith really wanted to be able to reach with with this work that he was doing. Like, this was not a guy who was regularly going to art shows or to art museums. And so Keith was really forthcoming with him, talking about the different figures in his drawings and why he's doing this project and so on. And so this man really developed a fondness for Haring and an attachment to this work. And then when he realized that these drawings are just going to be torn down and thrown in the trash or covered up, he took it upon himself for a while, when he was traveling around the city, to travel with a box cutter and a spackle knife. And when he thought he had a chance to salvage one of these drawings, he would do that. He would painstakingly scrape it off the wall, and he rolled it up and took it home with him. And from what we understand, he always just intended to keep these drawings for himself and maybe to pass down to his family. And he would take them out once a year to look at them.
But now they're ended up in your museum. So what changed?
Well, what changed was that late in his life, facing daunting medical bills and wanting to be able to pass an inheritance along to his family, he decided that it was time to sell the drawings. And so a collector in Connecticut, who is a real admirer of Keith Haring's work, acquired the drawings from this man, who died not long after. And I was introduced to this collector a couple of years ago through a mutual friend. And when I learned that he, among other artworks that he has, I learned that he had a collection of Keith Haring's subway drawings, I was, you know, over the moon and immediately interested in the possibility of showing them here at our museum. And he said, well, unfortunately, it's probably not going to work, because they're all headed to a contemporary art museum in Barcelona for a big show. And then some of them are already spoken for, but they're all basically going to be sold into private collections.
And so it sounds like you convinced him, though.
We quickly, rejiggered our schedule and shuffled things around so that before they go to Barcelona, they can be shown here in Brattleboro for 2 months.
Well, that's very exciting. And could you remind us again what the timing is of the exhibit?
Yeah, so the exhibit will open February 18th. That's a Saturday, and we'll have an opening reception. All are welcome at 5 p.m. And then the exhibit will be up until April 16th. And the museum is open to the public Wednesday through Sunday, 10 to 4. Admission is pay as you wish. So yeah, that's when you'll be able to come see them.
Great. And Danny, I want to make sure we have time to talk about another exhibit that I think is about to open, that we talked about maybe a year ago at this point. It's back. It's the Artful Ice Shanties exhibit, which pulls people outside of the walls of your museum and out into nature, right? Can you tell us about it?
Yes, exactly. And it just so happens that these things are opening at the exact same time. So also on February 18th is when this week-long outdoor exhibit will be taking place again for the third year in a row. It's called Artful Ice Shanties, a really fun project that was launched during COVID, because we were desperate to find ways to engage with audiences outside when people were really nervous about coming inside at the height of COVID. And so that's what gave rise to this really fun project that's now in its third year. And basically what we do is we invite builders and artists and students and teachers and people of all ages and backgrounds to create an ice shanty, like an ice fishing shanty, but that has some artful element to it, and deliver it here to Brattleboro, where it's going to be displayed out on the ice here, a body of water called the Retreat Meadows here in Brattleboro. And we have an artful ice shanty village that will be up for a week, and some of them actually work as ice fishing shanties. Some are a little more, shall we say, conceptual ice shanties, but they're all really fun to see and super creative. And we've done this the past 2 years, we've had thousands of people who come over the course of that week to come check out the shanties. And so we're anticipating a similar kind of response this year, really looking forward to it. We have about 17 people who have signed up to create artful ice shanties and have them be part of the exhibit this year.
Wow. Well, from New York City subway pop art to ice shanties inspired by ice fishing in Vermont, it sounds like there's a lot going on at the Brattleboro Museum. Danny Lichtenfeld is its director. Danny, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, Michaela, it's a pleasure. Thanks for doing this show today.
All right. Well, Danny just told us about this New York street artist, Keith Haring, whose work broke through to the art establishment. And here we are still talking about Haring decades later. And Burlington has its own street art culture. Many of its buildings have commissioned murals on them, and others have graffiti, just like in any other city. And to talk about the Queen City's street art, we're joined now by Vermont Public's Sunday Weekend Edition host, Marlon Hyde, who also does lots of great arts and culture reporting. Hey, Marlon, thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, Marlon, I know that Burlington has a ton of awesome street art, and I love driving around and checking out some of the stuff that I see up on buildings or, you know, tucked in back alleys. But I'm curious what one of your favorite pieces is.
One of my favorite pieces is titled Black Freedom, Black Madonna, and the Black Child of Hope. It sits on the side of the Fletcher Free Library. It was made by Rafaela Bryce and Josie Brunnell. It's a big, bright, holographic mural. It's made with vinyl, and it depicts a Black Madonna. It's a religious image, you know, Mary holding her child, Jesus. But this one is a Black reclamation of traditional Catholic imagery. Mm.
And I think I've seen this one before because it's really, the colors are like really vibrant, right? There's like gold and teal.
I'm telling you, the bright purple headdress literally stops passing patrons, and it just makes you question, like, what is this? What is going on? And that's the real power of art. It unlocks that childlike curiosity within everyone.
Speaking of artists, I see a couple common names on murals throughout the city. So I'm guessing there are a few artists that, you know, have done a lot of work in the Queen City here. Are there any artists who kind of stick out to you?
You know, Juniper Creative comes to mind. Every day I feel like they're quickly filling up walls and ceilings all around Burlington. You know, from the Kelly's the Afro Knot mural on the side of Champlain Elementary to Liberation Through Imagination on Pine Street. You know, I think my favorite mural is the Wall of Respect, Luminaries of Justice and Liberation. It's the one within Main Street Landing, and it took them, what, like 11 months to complete, and it contains over 100 faces of Black revolutionaries, whether they be local heroes, national heroes, or international heroes.
So cool. Wow. Well, I'll have to check that out. Marlon, outside of Burlington, do you have any favorite murals or street art that you'd want to tell us about?
Yeah, definitely. I know we talk about Burlington a lot, but there's so much great artwork all around the state. And especially our own Howard Wise Tisman put together a wonderful story about the Art Lords, a group of Afghan mural artists in Brattleboro. And they created 17 murals that were like recreations of murals that they created in Afghanistan.
Have you been to see them yet, or do you still have to get down there?
You know, I passed by a few when I was coming up from a trip down to Massachusetts. But, you know, one of the murals depicts children painting a pair of eyes on the wall, which at first I thought was kind of like, you know, a little different, a little interesting. But the eyes are actually from an original mural that was made in Afghanistan. And they put the eyes up there, and the children are made out of blue and green tape. So it looks like they're painting and adding it to their community. And I think it's just a really wonderful and touching piece of art that, you know, transcends worlds and stories alike.
Well, thanks so much for sharing these. I know I'm inspired to get out and walk around, see some art, even though it's very cold out right now. So Marlon Hyde, thank you.
Hey, anytime. Thank you so much for having me.
We just got an email from Dave Schmidt, who wants to give a plug for a show that he's organized for the Vermont Ski and Snowboard Museum in Stowe. He writes, it features the art of Vermont artist Scott Lenhart. Scott's created close to three decades worth of art for Burton Snowboards, including over 55 board graphics. And all pieces are done, quote, the old way, as actual paintings and drawings. For the exhibit, the museum's featuring over 100 pieces from simple concepts prototype drawings to some full-scale paintings of board graphics, along with 20 of the finished boards. So, Dave, thanks for telling us about it. And listeners, you can join the conversation, too. What is your favorite local art museum? Or are you an artist with new work you'd like to tell us about? Give us a call, 800-639-2211. You can also send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So next on our art tour, we are headed to Manchester, where Allison Kreitz is the manager of exhibitions and interpretive engagement at the Southern Vermont Arts Center. Allison, welcome.
Hi, Michaela.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Southern Vermont Arts Center. What's its history?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, we're in Manchester, so the southern part of the state, and we are open year-round, Tuesday through Sunday. SVAC is situated on about 100 acres of land, and we have a sprawling outdoor sculpture park that's really fun to wander around. Our land also abuts some wonderful hiking trails that are maintained by the Equinox Preservation Trust. And then our main campus has four main programming buildings, so they include a performing arts pavilion, where we have a lot of music and dance events in there. We have art studio space and feature a wide array of art classes and camps for all skill levels and ages. And then there are two buildings where our exhibition program takes place. So there's the Wilson Museum, and there's also the Yester House building. Our exhibition program is quite robust. We have about 10 shows a year, and they range from our all-member a member artist exhibition to solo exhibitions of individual artists, and then we also have thematically organized shows. We also have a wonderful cafe called Curate that's open Thursday through Sunday, and a great gift shop. So there's a lot to do when you come on campus.
Love it. Well, as you just mentioned, the center has a couple different exhibition spaces, and one is this beautiful estate that was built around the time of the First World War. Is that right? Like, what can visitors see there right now?
Yeah, that's right. So Yester House was built around 1917 by a woman named Gertrude Devine Webster. She was a summer resident. And she passed away in the late 40s, and her home became available on the market. And there was a group of artists called the Southern Vermont Artists who were really looking for a venue for a permanent home, really, to organize their group exhibitions. So they pooled the funds needed to purchase Yester House and converted it into gallery spaces. So having annual exhibitions of local artists has really been a part of SVAC's history since our founding in the early 1950s. And currently on view is our annual members exhibition. We have over 250 artist members. They're working in a range of media, painting, photography, 3D work, collage, printmaking, fiber and textile arts, ceramics, and more. And we accept submissions from anyone who wants to participate, and we try to put as much on the walls and in the galleries as we can fit. And all of the work is for sale. So when you come to the member show, if you find a piece you would like to own, it's a really wonderful opportunity to support local artists as well as SVAC.
Mm. And then in your newer wing, the Wilson Building, there's an exhibition on right now of works by Gail Winbury. And I was looking online at some of her work before the show. It's really, really beautiful, very abstract. And I'm not even going to try to visually describe it. I'm hoping that you could do a little bit better job than I could. But tell us about this Gail Winbury exhibit.
Absolutely. So this is a multidisciplinary exhibition. It's exploring themes of memory, specifically childhood memory, through the medium of art. We have about 3,000 square feet of gallery space over in the Wilson. this exhibition is called The Girl Who Drew Memories, and you're right, it's featuring the work of the New Jersey-based artist Gail Winbury. She works in both oils and collage. And really at the core of the show is a series of paintings that invite visitors to think about how we recall and make sense of our earliest memories and experiences. What's really interesting about Gail is that she actually has a background in psychology. She has a PhD in it, and she practiced as a clinical therapist for many decades before she turned to making art full time. And so this background, this training, really has given her a particular insight into the vagaries of memory, if you will. You know, memory is really complicated. It's cyclical. It's not linear. It often comes to us in fragments. Its meaning changes over time. We often struggle to find the right words to express our memories, and yet they are absolutely central to our sense of identity. So she's thinking about all this when she made this body of work. She actually sat down and created a list of all the memories from her childhood that had a really strong visual element to them, and then she systematically created a canvas based on each one of these memories of her childhood. And many of them are painful memories that she's reckoning with, but there are also really joyful and gentle moments in the exhibition, too.
That sounds so interesting. We just recently on Vermont Edition did a show about how smell is connected to memory, and it's had me thinking about how we kind of hold on to memories using all of our different senses. And so that sounds like a wonderful exhibition. I do want to take a call real quick. We have a call from Margaret in Barnett, Vermont. Margaret, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was just down at the Hood Museum at Dartmouth College and saw just an amazing exhibit by a Korean artist named Park Dae-sung. And they're huge ink wash paintings that he's done of landscapes and natural elements. Some of them are bigger than 25 feet long. There's a video that shows how he has a special roller that can roll it out so that he actually sits on the paper when he's doing the work and then rolls it up to paint on it. But they're just absolutely gorgeous. So I highly recommend it. There's great support for it in terms of the videos and the docents who helped at the exhibit. And it was a wonderful show.
Well, Margaret, thanks so much for telling us about it. And in just a moment, we'll be joined by a curator from Dartmouth's Hood Museum as well to tell us a bit more about what's going on at that institution. But first, back to the Southern Vermont Arts Center. Allison, I know there's a couple different exciting exhibitions coming up. Could you maybe pick your favorite one that's coming down the pike pretty soon and tell us a bit more about it?
Sure. It's always hard to choose your favorite.
I know.
I'll pick a summer exhibition, which is called the Red Dress Project. This opens on July 1st in our Wilson Museum. SVC is actually going to be the first U.S. venue to showcase the Red Dress Project. It's a global collaborative embroidery project that's taken 13 years to complete.
Wow.
And at the core of the show is a haute couture red dress that's made out of silk dupion. It weighs about 14 pounds, and it features the hand-stitched contributions of over 370 participants from 50 countries around the world. The majority of them are women, many of whom are vulnerable and living in impoverished situations and who are rebuilding their lives through embroidery. And the project was founded by a UK-based artist. Her name is Kirsty McLeod. And as you can imagine, it's really become this platform for self-expression for everyone who's contributed to the dress. And what's particularly exciting is that alongside the red dress, we are having a replica of the dress made in white calico. And that's going to be open to community members and visitors to decorate, to stitch onto. Maybe we'll even introduce some fabric markers, but really to add local voices to the dress in the same spirit of the Red Dress Project. So for all the embroiderers out there listening today, if this piques your curiosity, we have a sign-up sheet on the Red Dress exhibition page on SVAC's website. And please add your name to that list, and you'll get some updates about how to get involved with this community dress initiative.
Wonderful. Well, I'm excited to check that out. That gives us something to look forward to this summer. Allison Kreitz is the manager of exhibitions and interpretive engagement at the Southern Vermont Arts Center in Manchester. Allison, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
And we also just heard from the Bennington Museum via email. They say the museum recently purchased for their permanent collection two pieces of Pedra Bramhall's early work. The pieces are important examples of the glass art movement. And Bramhall is a native Vermont artist who entered and started blowing glass art in the 60s and ran the longest running hot shop from 1970 to 2008. So thank you to the Bennington Museum for writing us. Our last stop today on our art tour is over the state border in New Hampshire at Dartmouth's Hood Museum. Michael Hartman is the Associate Curator of American Art. Michael, welcome.
Hello, Michaela. Thank you for having me.
Well, Michael, tell us a little bit about the Hood Museum. What's its history?
Yeah, the Hood Museum was founded in 1985 on Dartmouth College's campus. There had always been art collections here, but in the 1980s, Dartmouth went through a concerted effort to take the collections spread out, you know, in the art department, the history department, anthropology, and give them a building where everything could be housed together. And we have a mission that is really to work first, you know, with Dartmouth students. We are a teaching museum on a college campus. But then, you know, second, we really do try to work closely with our public, and that includes school children. Hmm. We recently went through a large renovation project in 2019 that added significant exhibition and teaching space.
Hmm. Well, I know that the museum does a lot of work to kind of react to and reflect topics that are bubbling up in the community on the Dartmouth campus and in the broader community in the Upper Valley. And one of the examples of that, as I understand it, is kind of your theme for this coming year, art and the construction of history. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So for the first time, we are trying to theme all of our exhibitions together and try and determine what the through line is. So in 2023, our exhibitions really explore the way that art has shaped our understanding of history. So we're looking into how artworks become systems of sharing knowledge, how artworks help us shape our ideas about the past and present. So part of this is looking to historical works and asking new questions of them that might tell a more complete and complicated history, while at the same time trying to incorporate artists and voices and stories that haven't always been included within art museums.
Hmm. And one example of one of those works is an image that I'm guessing a lot of us can kind of conjure up in our minds, right, when you say the title, Washington Crossing the Delaware. Tell us about this.
Yes. So in our entrance gallery this year, we have a oil on canvas, incomplete study for Emmanuel Leutze's Washington Crossing the Delaware. On view for the first time, I believe, since the mid-1970s, loaned to us from a private collection. And the work itself is incomplete. You can see George Washington, you can see the American flag behind him, but all the other figures in the boat and the boat itself are only sketched in. So as we're inviting people into this space to think about how artists are constructing history, we can see that happening in this artwork. Hmm.
And I this is a little bit outside of that topic, but I did see on your website that you have an ongoing work by Laura Mays called Spikes at the Museum, which somehow the description says it makes the sun's energy audible. And since this is radio and I'm a big audio nerd, I have to hear a little bit more about what this one is.
Yeah. Laura Mays is a Belgian sound artist and composer, and this artwork essentially has a solar panel outside, and then inside all of these LEDs that are tracked to it. So as the sun moves across the sky, you hear more sound created from these LEDs. And, you know, if a cloud passes by, the sounds kind of taper off or slow down or stop. On a completely cloudy day or a snowy day, you might only hear just a click here or there. Hmm. And this work really invites us to think about our local environment. You know, what is happening outside the museum?
Mm. Well, looking to the future, what are some exhibitions coming down the pike that you're really excited about?
So one of the most exciting exhibitions that's coming up is Printing the Revolution, The Rise and Impact of Chicano Graphics, 1965 to now, which originated at the Smithsonian American Art Museum and traveled to Fort Worth, Texas, and now is coming to the Hood Museum at Dartmouth. It features 119 works of art that will fill 7 of the museum's 16 galleries. So this exhibition really starts in the mid-1960s at this moment of vast societal change and looks at how artists, Mexican-American artists who adopt this term Chicano as an identifier of their political and cultural identity, seek to make works that advocate for social and political change. So in the first gallery, you'll encounter a lot of works that were advocating for labor rights in the 1960s, the United Farm Workers Union. and migrant workers as well. And then as you move through the space, you get into other topics, both domestic and global politics and history, immigration. There are works that talk about feminism and women's rights, LGBTQ plus rights, and racial equality, as well as environmental change. So I think that there's a lot in this show that can entice viewers to come and better understand how this story, which hasn't always been told in a museum, these Chicano artists are really integrated into the fabric of the United States.
Well, we have just about 30 seconds left until we have to take a break, but could you also tell us about one other exhibition that you'd mentioned to me that's opening up in April?
Yes. So in April, we'll be opening an exhibition called Kent Monkman, The Great Mystery. Kent Monkman is a First Nations artist of Cree, of the Cree Nation, and he's best known for recent work at the Met that really deconstruct history and how it's told. Monkman has come in and mined our collection and is creating artworks inspired by what is at Dartmouth. So this is going to be a unique local story. And I think it'll be really exciting for people to see what he creates hung alongside the works from our collection that provided that inspiration.
Wow. Well, Michael Hartman, the Associate Curator of American Art at the Hood Museum at Dartmouth, thanks so much for talking us through these exhibitions. We appreciate it.
Thank you.